This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com. All right, good evening, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Podstaff. With me tonight, I have Mr. Ryan Poulsen. Ryan is a staffing professional. He had a little bit of a culinary background as well, and he's got a hell of a recovery journey. So, Ryan, I'll let you tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm Ryan Poulsen. I'm a CEO for a staffing agency here in Phoenix, Arizona. We specialize in multifamily, which is apartment communities, property management teams, on-site staffing mostly. I attempt to hire temporary employees, a lot of like onboarding, payroll servicing, but that's pretty much the gist of it. Like, we do either temporary fill-in, emergency fill-ins, temp to hire, or we'll do payroll service where they can bring on their own people and kind of try before you buy type thing.
Yeah. So is there like buyout fees associated with that, or is it just kind of you have to work X amount of days or time period before you can work there full time as an in-house employee?
Yeah, we used to do buyout fees, but it's so competitive. There's tons of staffing agencies out there. So one of the ways we kind of got ahead of it is we eliminated buyout fees. So for us, there's no buyout fees. We just find the people. We let them, we recommend 2 weeks, but we kind of just leave it up to them. If you like them and you feel like, you got a good gauge on if they're going to stick around, then take them right away. We don't care. We want to build that long-term, that trust and that long-term relationship with them.
Yeah. So how's the reliability for a lot of these people that are picking up these jobs?
It's tough. I think multifamily, especially, like, you're dealing with like the maintenance techs who education backgrounds, like, kind of iffy sometimes. So like the reliability is rough. I mean, there's a high turnover rate in multifamily.
Gotcha. So whenever you say multifamily, for our listeners who don't really understand what that is, can you explain that a little bit? Like, what constitutes something in that industry being a multifamily?
Yeah, it's like apartment communities. I would say like anything from like duplex up to like 1,000 units. So like it could be 2 units, it could be 1,000 units. It's just it's multifamily is where it's a community, pretty much a residential community, to duplex or above.
Yeah, no, I mean, makes sense to me. I do want to talk about briefly your culinary background. We talked a little bit about that. I thought it was pretty interesting that, you had a culinary background and then now you're, running a staffing company in the multifamily space. So tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, so I always had a passion for cooking. Like, since I was a kid, I loved it. I was always around my mom when she was cooking, my grandma, same thing. I was just, anytime they were in the kitchen cooking, I was there trying to get my hands in there and learn anything I could. So I had that passion, and that's what I wanted to do. And multifamily was just kind of always in the background, just because that's what my mom did, So anyway, I went into culinary school, Arizona Culinary Institute. I did that. Schooling was never, no matter what it was, even like trade school like that, it was never something I liked to do. So I didn't do particularly well in the culinary school, but I did, like, in the hands-on stuff, I killed it, So I did well in that part, but I was like kind of, I barely passed in culinary school just because there is a lot of written and like studying involved and like doing written tests and not a lot of hands-on stuff. So anyway, I got out of culinary school barely, and then I went and did some externships and went out and cooked for a couple places. I went to Oregon, Oregon's a weird, Oregon's kind of a weird spot, but it's cool. Like, it's just different. But I went there, did a little bit of my externship. I ended up, and we'll probably dive back into this, but I ended up getting asked to leave from that place. And then I went to Petoskey, Michigan, where my family's all from Michigan. So that was actually kind of cool because my grandma lived pretty close to there. So went to Petoskey, finished my externship, and I was also asked to leave that place too. And we'll get into all that later, but they signed my externship paper and let me complete it, but I didn't actually complete it. They were just like, hey, you gotta go, dude. So
was not well at that time.
Yeah, exactly. But that was the culinary stuff, and what happened, I got out of the externship. I worked in some kitchens, and it's really chaotic, and you have, like, you've seen, like, the shows on TV, like Gordon Ramsay. It's really like that in some of the professional kitchens, where, like, these chefs are yelling and screaming, and for me, I just don't do well with it. Like,
That sounds horrible. I thought that was just like the Gordon Ramsay show. Like, I thought that was all kind of a facade put on, but that's interesting to hear that that's actually how it is. I personally don't think I could operate, you know, unless I was in high school football again. I can't operate with someone yelling in my face.
It was kind of like that. It was kind of like a drill sergeant coach. And, like, depending on what kind of kitchen, they're assholes. And, like, me, I don't take well to authority like that, especially, like, aggressive. So, like, I'm just like, there's no way I can do this because I'm going to end up fighting the executive chef or something like that. And it just wasn't for me. And I ended up getting out of that. And that's kind of when there's a lot of stuff that happened. But I kind of ended up working for my mom, just kind of part-time doing just, you know, random gigs for her, even like as far as being a temp and going out and picking up trash and doing maintenance work, filling in the office every once in a while. But I was kind of like a nomad. I bounced around to California and Arizona. I did moving gigs. It was just for a long period of my time after cooking, I was doing the working for my mom and then kind of just doing whatever else just to kind of make a little bit of money. Even though, yeah, I kind of had it made where my mom was helping me out a lot, which is, the story's kind of wild. We're going to get into it, but that's kind of my life after cooking.
Yeah. So from picking up trash here and there to, running this whole company yourself. I think that's pretty impressive. I feel like a lot of times, especially like family run businesses, I've seen some of those, in action, and you see, like, you know, the son or the daughter is the CEO after like a year of working there or something like that. And then you've got employees that have been there and know things, that have been going on for the last 10 years that you probably have no idea what's going on. But I think that's cool that she made you kind of start at the bottom and work your way up.
Oh yeah. I did a lot of the grunt work and for sure worked my way up, but it could have been the other way too. Like, I don't know. Like, I feel like it would have happened that way. Like, she would have done that too, but thank God it didn't happen that way. Plus, as we get into more of this, the way I was, it could have been bad.
Yeah. Well, I do want to jump into that. Before we do, I just kind of want to talk about how we got connected. Cause you know, this podcast is relatively new, you know, it's not even a year old. And I don't really have a lot of followers on LinkedIn, but I just saw a random message pop into my LinkedIn inbox, and it was you asking, you know, if we could talk about you being on the podcast. So I remember kind of what you told me about that, but tell us for our listeners kind of how that came full circle.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. So I was, there's a guy called Andy Frisella, and he runs a company called First Form. He's in charge. He's the one that started 75 Hard. I can't remember if you said you heard of that, but it's a mental toughness program. Anyway, he started that company, and then he started this new app called the Operational Standard. And in that app, every day you have to complete 5 tasks. And in the beginning of the app, when you sign up, you kind of it has like a ChatGPT AI type thing, and you go in and you tell it basically everything you want to do with your life from that moment into the future. And I just got into telling it about just what I want to do. And one day, one of the 5 tasks that I had was get booked on a podcast, you know, reach out and get booked on a podcast. So, you know, I'm just like, all right, let's do it. And I went on LinkedIn and just started looking at podcasts, and yours popped up, and the pod staff kind of got, that's what, like, I was like, oh, staff, you know, let's hit this guy up and see what happened. And I didn't know anything about how many followers you had or anything like that. I was just like, let's go. And yeah, you got back to me super quick, and I was amazed, actually. I'm like, holy shit, I'm gonna be on this podcast, you know? Yeah. So yeah, it's a funny but kind of cool little story how I got connected with you.
Yeah, I know. And you know, this, like, your story is incredible. I can't wait to, you know, have it be shared on here. And you know, we've talked a little bit about faith and what that means to us too. You know, faith for you, faith in Jesus Christ, and
yes,
and for me as well. But I think that there's been so many times in my life, this included, where God just places someone or something right in front of you, and you're like, okay. I mean, if the more random, in my opinion, the better, because that means that it was orchestrated by someone that's not me. I feel like those are the special scenarios whenever, you know, something just falls in your lap and you get connected with someone like you or like me or just, you know, whatever it may be. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I do. I think it's from God as well. Like, I've come to learn, and we talked about this a little bit on our call, is like, when you reflect and you look back, you start to notice things, and like, this kind of stuff just heightens it more. Like, everything happens for a reason. And when it's just random like that, you know, oh, this was supposed to happen. You know, like, right, this was part of the plan.
Yeah. So I want to jump into it, man. Let's talk about, we're going to talk about sobriety. We're going to talk about, you know, some crazy stories that have happened, you know, in that journey. And then I also want to talk about faith. So I'm not going to give you an order. Just start from the top and give us your story, man.
I come from a really good family. Like, they're supportive. But I did have tragedy, like, right away, which... My father died when I was 2 years old, and that kind of, like, I didn't really notice or know, you know, like, kind of take it. I'm 2 years old, so I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but it is part of it. So, like, yeah, that happened. But I have my dad, who's my father now, he raised me. So, like, I kind of don't, that's why I'm saying, I don't know if that had anything to do with the way I turned out, like all the rebelness or whatever. But anyway, that's the beginning of the story. So right away, my father died pretty shortly after my mom remarried, and that's who my father, I call my dad. You know, he's not my biological, but he adopted me. He adopted my brother. He raised us. We come from a good home, played sports. Like I said, they're very supportive, but there was, I don't know, I was always just getting into trouble and just wanted to be, like, rebellious. I didn't listen to anybody. You know, I just kind of did whatever I wanted. So anyway, I think it was like the 7th grade or something. That's when I got into alcohol and drugs. And my friend's parents, they had like a liquor cabinet, a bar, like right out in front. And my parents had liquor too, but it was hidden. So maybe that's why I never really thought about it before then. But they had it right in front, and we hit it one day, and something, like, in me kind of was just, and I've all, let me rephrase. I've always been kind of a shy kid from growing up, you know. And I remember the first time I had a drink, I was like, oh wow, you know, like, I can really let loose and be free here.
You're like Superman, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I was I just didn't care. I would say whatever. I remember he had a neighbor. We had a neighbor, and it was this girl, and her friend were over there. And I remember being so scared of girls, like, in the beginning, you know, like, when before alcohol, I was always shy. And then with the alcohol, I was over there talking to the girls, and you know, we ended up, you know, we hooked up with the girl, and it made you feel good, like, oh, okay, this is something, but you know, this is something that like helps me, and mm-hmm. which is weird because it's not that, you know, but anyway.
So would you say that you were like immediately off to the races, like, because I hear it different in a lot of people, where some people are like, it was fine for a while, but. Some people say as soon as that alcohol touched my lips or that drug, I took a hit of that drug or whatever, they were like, as soon as that happened, I knew that I liked this and this is what I was going to do.
Yeah, it was right away. I felt like you get this warm feeling. I'm like, I am, like you said, Superman. I can do whatever I want. And I took notice because as soon as I got sober or whatever, I'm talking not sober in life, but just after, you know, you got drunk when you were a kid, when you sobered up, I was like, oh, I was back to the shy guy, you know, and like just kind of head down, just doing my own thing. And I would just remember like, God, I want that feeling. I want to be like the guy that gets attention type thing, you know? So I would just drink, and we drank shit almost like every day from seventh grade on until I was like 35, you know what I mean? Like crazy. Like it was like that. And again, when I say that, remember we're kids, so I'm not like pounding bottles and bottles. We had to sneak it. But when you're young, you can, you know, a little bit goes a long way. So we were just, you know, taking shots every once in a while. And yeah, man, it was pretty crazy. Like I said, it made me feel great. I remember getting drunk, going to high school, going to school, doing it.
Wow. Did you ever get caught in school drunk?
I got caught a lot, especially in high school. Like I got actually kicked out of high school, and I had to end up being homeschooled. Wow. At that junior high where we started drinking, I got kicked out of that school and had to go. My parents put me in like a Catholic school, and that's where I started smoking weed, believe it or not. Like actually, I'm sure you can't believe it, but in Catholic school, they're not like good kids, you know, they still do stuff too. So I remember getting introduced to weed. I had a buddy, his parents were hippies, and we found their stash, and we would just go off in these orange groves behind his house, smoke weed, drink a little bit, and it was just like, it was fun for me, you know.
Now what about the paint a picture for like the type of town you lived in? Was it like a small town, everyone knows everyone, or was it a big community?
So Gilbert, Arizona, and then kind of Mesa. I grew up kind of both of them. The Catholic school was in Mesa, and my high school and all that was in Gilbert. So I had friends on both sides. But no, it's a suburb. It's
It was a good sized community. Like yeah, there was a lot of people.
Yeah.
And there was plenty of places to hide off and go do stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. Especially back then, because it wasn't as built up as it is now. I mean, it was still pretty built up, but like, we had a dirt field behind our house. We had like this empty lot next to our house that had like an unfinished house with bricks, and we'd make forts in there and do all that kind of. That was like our little clubhouse, you know. So, yeah, there's enough open space to go do whatever the hell we wanted.
Gotcha. So, all right, you're drinking every day from seventh grade on. You kind of discover weed. At what point did you discover any other drugs?
So it was like, it was later on, probably after high school, I played in a band too, which is kind of weird. I had like a reggae band, if you've heard of Sublime. It was like that. And I remember, because the lead singer of Sublime died of a heroin overdose. And I remember telling myself, I'll never do anything like that. I like weed and alcohol. That's all I need. And I got into painkillers. It was kind of how I got addicted to him. I had a girlfriend, and she was like, "You're way more lovable when because you know alcohol makes you kind of, you know, I'm a rowdy guy, so alcohol made me rowdy. Painkillers made me chill. You know what I mean? So like my girlfriend at the time told me, "You're way more lovable when you're on these pills," and she didn't know it at the time, but that was like, oh, okay, I'm going to start popping these. So like, you know, you think I'm a little bit nicer or whatever. So I that's how I got into painkillers. And then one day, one of my buddies didn't have the painkillers, and he had heroin. And that was the first time I tried heroin. And that from that day on, it was, that was it. That was like my drug of choice at that point.
I feel like it just, for a lot of people, including myself, you know, I've, you know, seen a lot of people try a lot of different things, and I've, you know, I have a friend who, was a heroin addict. I have a friend who was a fentanyl addict. And they're, you know, they cleaned up their act and got themselves right now, which is awesome. But from a young age, like, I remember heroin being like, they teach you in school, like, stay away from drugs, especially like heroin, 'cause you get addicted, you get hooked, immediately. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, like, how much desperation do you need to have, or is it just like a, fuck it, I'm just gonna try this. Like yeah. what was going through your mind?
It was just like that. I'm just like, fuck it, I'm gonna try it. You know, because like I didn't have any. I was taking Vicodins and Percocets, and they didn't. And he didn't have that. And he was very, like, convincing of, dude, this is try this. Like, you'll like it. I think I was like 23 or 24 at that time. So I was a little older, but, like I said, I didn't want to try. I never thought I would ever try that. But it wasn't, he was very, like, persuasive with it. And he just convinced me that this is okay. Like, it's a substitute, you know, like, just try it. And like I was telling you, I smoked it. I didn't shoot it. So for anybody that's never done it, when you smoke heroin, like it's called chasing the dragon or whatever. And you, well, this is what I called it, but on the foil, like the little, it's like you have this little ball, you put it on a foil and the thing just kind of runs down, you light underneath and it runs down and you like chase it with your straw and you smoke it. And that was like, for some reason, it was so cool to me to do. And that kind of like, it was fun. So like, that was another thing. And then blowing the smoke out and like, I don't know. It was weird. And I got addicted to that part of it more than anything.
Wow. So, but I'm assuming you were physically addicted to.
Oh yeah. 100%. And yeah, really the first time I found out I was addicted to it, I remember I didn't have any, and I was like, kind of, I was physically sick. Like you've heard of heroin withdrawals, and your body gets like achy and you get cold and all this stuff. And I remember telling my friend, he wanted to hang out because I was in a band. He wanted to practice and play some music. And I'm like, dude, I don't feel good today. He's like, oh, dude, you're sick. You just need a little. You need some dope. And I was like, all right, you know, like, bring it over. Let's see. And I smoked it. It wasn't like that. All right, bring it over. I was like, I don't know, man. I just feel like shit. I feel sick. And he brought it over. Sure enough, dude, as soon as I hit that, everything, I felt normal.
So you didn't know at first, like, no, that was surprising.
Yeah.
Okay. So you really thought like, hey, I've got the flu or something.
Yeah. I thought I had the flu, and going back to it, I wish I would have just not talked to him that day. Cause it might've been a lot easier to get off of it. But that was the first day I realized anytime I feel sick now, it just means I don't have this and all I need is a couple hits and I'll feel better. So from there, that's when it like really spiraled. Like I was stealing from my parents. I pawned stuff from my brother. I pawned my band equipment. Like it got really bad at that point.
Wow. Yeah, I've heard that. And I just feel like you have to be in such a fixated, unwell state of mind to steal from like your family and stuff. But you hear it all the time. So it's like, and that's where like addicts and alcoholics and, you know, whatever you want to call it, I feel like that's where people only see it for what it looks like, where it's like, wow, you must be a horrible person. You stole something from your family. That's yeah, horrible. But that's not really, like, you can be a good person and still be sick at the same time. And I would assume that you weren't thinking at the time, what's this going to make my mom think? Or what's this going to make my dad think? I'm assuming you were thinking, I've got to have this and this is how I get it.
Right. I didn't. Yeah. Honestly, it's sad, sucks to say, but I didn't care. You know, like I know I needed to get that any way I could. And that's what I did, you know? So,
yeah. So after that, you know, you've got, some experience now doing some pretty hard drugs. You're still drinking. Where did you go from there?
I mean, I did that for a while. I think like 5-6 years. I got into some other stuff too, but it was really just that I loved. Like I tried. I remember trying crack, and that one was kind of weird because like I liked it because you blew out like a shitload of smoke, and I remember thinking how cool. Everything always comes back to like, man, that was cool. You know, like I thought like, wow, that's a big cloud of smoke. You ever see like the vapes?
Yeah,
The
yeah,
people
yeah.
that vape, it was like that, and it was just like I remember that. I was kind of infatuated with that or fixated on that for a little bit, but heroin was still the one. And then I had like my girlfriend who I was with forever, the same one that I kind of got. I don't want to blame it on anybody because I got on it myself, but the same one that kind of like said, "Hey, you're much more lovable when you're on, you know, Vicodin and shit." And her dad actually died of a heroin overdose when she was a baby, and she ended up like breaking up with me because of it. And I loved this girl, like I was in love with her. And I remember like that's when I wanted to start to try to get clean. So it was probably, I think I was like 20, 28, 29, and I started trying to get clean. And when I would go up to my parents' house, and they would, that's why I said I had a very supportive family. Like nobody ever kicked me out or, I mean, friends or whatever, but my parents and my family was always right there trying to help me get better, even after I stole from them. So they took me in. I got clean probably like 3 or 4 times, but I would always relapse.
How long in between?
You know, the longest I did and then relapse was probably like 3 or 4 months, wow. Which isn't very long, but, yeah. And then, when I finally got clean, I moved out to California. I think I was like 30 years old. I was living in Ocean Beach, San Diego, and I was taking methadone, which is it's an opiate blocker kind of thing. And it like helps you get off of it.
It makes you sick, right? If you do take them.
It supposedly doesn't work. Like if you take it just doesn't work. But it does get you, like methadone can get you high too. It's almost like a replacement. So in the beginning when I was taking methadone, I was taking it to replace it. But I just, something in me said, dude, you have to get off this. You know, you have to get off this. So I just started going down in dosing. And then one day, I just kind of like, I was at like a super low dose and I just ended up getting off of it. But I'm not going to lie, like alcohol came back into my life. And like, I think that's really what helped me get off of it. Because when I was at that low dose, I was starting to drink a little bit more. And that's when drinking came back into my life and it was, pretty dominant.
Yeah. So where next?
So I lived in Ocean Beach, got off heroin. I was drinking. It was a party town too. Ocean Beach is a party town in San Diego. And I was just wild, like just drinking every night, partying with like crazy people, motorcycle clubs, like dangerous people. I didn't do drugs because at that point I was like, you know, heroin, I'll never touch that again. Never, ever, ever. Not even a painkiller. But I smoked weed and drank. One time I was at this party and it was at my house anyway. And we were drinking. It was just a block party. And we were all drinking and I was in my house at the block party. And I got in a little argument with my girlfriend at the time. And I remember I fell through the window. Like I was hammered, just doing stupid shit. And I fell through the window, ripped my whole tricep, almost fell out of my whole arm, and I had to go to the hospital for that. And I remember them like trying to give me painkillers, and I was like, no, I can't, you know, I'm not doing that. I don't want to do any painkillers. So anyway, didn't do that, but I had like this tube hanging out of my arm, and a lot of these things I'm saying because I mean some of these like stories like this is enough for some people to be like, I think I got to slow down, but for me it was just like, no, I'm not slowing down. I'm going to keep going. It's kind of like fun stories, you know?
It seems like you have a lot of them. Some people have, you know, a car accident or something like that. And they're like, yeah, I should probably stop. And then maybe they do, or maybe they moderate. But I think maybe for the true addict, like that's not something that crosses your mind. Like, well, yeah, maybe I, I could just moderate this. I mean, I'm sure you would have wanted to, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, I loved it. Like I said, it goes back to the beginning with alcohol. Like, it made me feel untouchable. And I remember, like, alcohol to me, like, goes back to the beginning. Like, I felt like it made people like me more. Even if they were, like, laughing at me, that didn't register. Like, I'm getting attention. So, like, even out there when I was older drinking, like, I got a lot of attention. Like, I felt like I was, like, the cool kid on the block or the cool guy on the block. Everybody, like, I remember my house was like a clubhouse. Like, everybody would be there. We would all be drinking and partying. And looking back on it, like, people, even into high school, like, everybody, I see these people now as they were taking advantage of me, kind of like, just, he'll do the stupid stuff and you know, just really using me in a way, I guess. But anyway, there's a lot of crazy stories like that. Like, my friends throwing me in through my top window, not breaking windows, but just like dragging me down the street drunk because I couldn't walk, throwing me through my window, like dropping on my bed. I remember like somehow walking in my house and tripping over my cord, my TV fell down on my head. And like I woke up with the TV on top of me, my friends were laughing and just like kind of crazy drunk stories like that. And there was a one night too where me and my buddy were just drinking at my house, getting just hammered. And we had an idea to go down to this local bar where all, like, you know, our other friends hung out, like the motorcycle club guys and stuff. And on our way down there, there was this guy talking to these girls. And he was with them, but he was kind of like aggressively talking to them and just drunk, thinking I was cool. I'm like, hey, don't talk to girls like that. And he was like, what? You know, like, talk, you know, we started yapping back and forth. And I walked over there because, like, that was just me. I didn't care. You know, if you said it was on, it was on. So I walked over there. I hit the dude, got on top of him. And he pulled out, I didn't know this at the time, but he pulled out a knife and stabbed me in my back 7 times. And he got my buddy. Wow. My buddy tried to pull me off. And he got my buddy in the chest and cut his whole chest open. He almost died in the hospital. And like I said, I didn't know about this, so I didn't know I was stabbed yet. When we were all up walking, I was chasing him, the guy that stabbed me. I was chasing him down the street, believe it or not, and dripping blood. And my wife now, which is funny because she lived in the apartments right on the corner where the ambulance ended up taking me away. She she was telling me there was blood like all over the concrete right out in front of her house. So, but yeah, I didn't know I got stabbed. The ambulance got there and they're like, you know, you got some stab wounds. And again, wow. I didn't take any painkillers. Got to the hospital and they had this gauze. They were stuffing gauze in my wounds. And the knife was, I think they said it was 6 inches or something. Something crazy.
Oh, wow.
I can't remember the exact size, but it wasn't small.
So they like hit stab your kidneys or anything like that?
No,
like,
and I was lucky. Like they were telling me like I was like inches away type thing from like being paralyzed because it was like right in my back, almost by my spine. I have some on my sides too, but they were stuffing this gauze in my wounds. And I remember I'm like, I'm not taking any type of painkillers. And as they were stuffing those things in, I broke. I'm like, dude, you have to give me something. Like I can't take that type of pain. That's just a little side note. Like I just took it for that day. I didn't end up getting back on it or anything like that. But that,
well, yeah,
that
I mean, stuffing
the worst. Yeah.
Yeah, stuffing gauze in an open, stuffing anything in an open wound without anything to numb. I mean, that's like insane. I can't imagine what that felt like.
Yeah, drunk, it was okay. Like when I got there and they did it, I was like, you know, whatever, no drugs, right? But that morning when I was sobered up, that's when it was like, oh yeah, hell no, like I need something. But one of the craziest stories. There's one more crazy one I'm going to get to, but I remember that one was like a badge of honor. I thought I was the shit. So like there was no plans to stop drinking. I thought I was cool. And I also had my friends be like, dude, I can't believe you chased that dude down the street after you got stabbed. And like, it was like, I was like, oh shit, I'm like almost like a local celebrity right now. This was in the paper. Like,
I had got that attention that you had been craving.
Right. Yeah. And I had friends from back home calling me like, you know, well, you got stabbed. And like, I was just like, oh shit. Okay. So yeah, I thought I was the man. So that didn't stop. I was like, as soon as I got out of the hospital, like I remember I was drinking. So, that didn't stop. I probably maybe even got a little worse.
Wow. Yeah, I feel like after something like that, it's like you said earlier, most people would be like, hey, I think I should probably chill. But that was like a badge of honor, like you said, for you, which is, I can understand that. But at the same time, like you could have died, like you almost died. So it's like, I feel like at that point, it's either screw it, I'm going all in, or hey, I'm probably going to need to, you know, sober up and clean up my act so I don't die.
Right. And that's what kind of what I think, like, it was like almost I'm going all in. And I remember even thinking, because like I said, it was almost like I was getting a lot of praise, and I hung out with some rough people. Like, I'm talking, like, two of the guys I used to hang out with all the time, they were my best friends at the time. They're locked up in prison for life right now. So, like, I was kind of, like, with that crowd where I literally, it sounds so stupid right now, but, like, I wanted to be like in that club gang type life, and that was like, okay, we're in now, bro. You got stabbed. Like you're like, you're gangster, you know, like that kind of thing. So yeah, man, it was just wild. Like I rolled with it. I kind of like turned into that character. I'd always kind of been aggressive, especially when I drank, like fighting, but it got even worse after that. Like I literally thought I was the shit, and I would fight anybody. I carried a knife with me at that time, like, because I, you know, I'm not getting stabbed again, and I'm gonna stab you if we do get into this, you know. So yeah, it got way worse. My ego, like my person, like I got worse as a person. The alcohol, like I never got stabbed or anything like that again, but my person, like I was the worst person after that.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So the drinking kind of was the same, or I mean, it was already out of control. So it was just kind of what it was.
Right.
And then you kind of turned into a much shittier human at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. So how long ago was that?
So I'm 43. That was, I believe I was like 34, 35. So like 8 years ago, something like that.
Yeah. Wow. So after that, because you're in California at that point in time. So at what point did you move back? And I know that there was something else that you were going to share about just kind of an incident. But kind of walk us through like the timeline from that story to this other story.
Yeah, so that after that, it was probably maybe 2 years, maybe a year to 2 years. I can't remember, but I went back to Arizona, moved out of that place. And it wasn't, I don't think at the time it didn't have anything to do with like who I was hanging out with or drinking or anything like that. I even remember after I got stabbed, they were like, dude, most people like, you know, they leave OB. That was kind of a thing. People leave OB if shit goes bad or whatever. And I remember when I lived there, like I saw people leave, you know, come and go. And I'm like, nah, I'm not going nowhere, you know. But I did end up leaving. But like I said, it wasn't because of that. I went home. I ended up staying with my parents in Prescott. Like I said, about a year, maybe 2 years after that, still drinking. When I lived up with my parents, it was like probably even, I don't want to say worse with my drinking, but I was able to save a lot more money. So I had more money. I felt like better with, you know, the more money you have, I don't know, for me at the time, I felt better. So when I went out, I could really like be flashy, you know, trying to pick up
girls. How are you making money at this time?
Just, I was working for my mom. Like I was doing like just kind of recruiting stuff, not anything more than just calling people, hey, do you need work? I got a property I can put you at. So, you know, that's what I would do. And then she paid.
And that's me. What you were doing in California too?
California, I was moving furniture. So, like, I would pick up these gigs. I remember there was this, like, Russian guy. He had a trailer. And I would go there every morning when I wasn't, like, too trashed. And he would send us out on jobs, and I would just go move furniture. And that's, and like I said, I come from a really good family. My mom took care of me, too. Like, she paid my rent and stuff like that. So all the money I made for moving, that was just party money. So, but yeah, moved back to Prescott. My mom paid me pretty well. I would always, my brother lived in Gilbert. So like I would come down on the weekends and I would stay with my brother and just get trashed and go to bars and do that whole thing. Then this is kind of like my first, I don't want to say it's not my first interaction with God, because there was a part of the story where I left out. My dad had introduced me to a book called The Men of God. And that was when I was still in California, probably a little bit before I left. And now thinking about it, that might have something to do with it. But that book called Men of God opened my eyes up a little bit to like, okay, you know, let's think about this a little bit. But anyway, moved back, hanging out with my brother every weekend, getting drunk. And then I remember one day I was like, I felt lonely. Like, it's weird to say, I just felt lonely. And I remember I prayed to God. I was like, man, God, send me my soulmate. I can't even believe I'm like saying this stuff, but God, send me my soulmate. And my wife, she's the girl that was at that apartment complex where she saw the blood on the curb. And I was hanging out with her a little bit in OB, but she called me like the next day. And I always had like, I had a thing for her. Like it was never right timing, but we always kind of like, we always tried, you know?
Right.
And she called me the next day and we just started talking every day. And then she ended up coming to visit me and I went and visited her, and that whole thing kind of connected. And next thing you know it, I moved back to San Diego for a little bit, just for like maybe 3 or 4 months, proposed to her, get married, moved back to Arizona. Again, I'm still kind of drinking and stuff, but not every day, just like on the weekends, you know, like maybe a little more than that. But it wasn't as bad. But I would still get trashed. Like when I drank to get drunk. I didn't drink just to have a couple drinks and you know, whatever. I got trashed. So one day we went up to a cabin with my brother, a couple friends of ours, and we were up there watching a Duke game. Duke's my favorite basketball team. We always would get together and watch the Duke games. They were playing Syracuse on that night. And my brother's girlfriend, she, I always kind of had like this little thing against her. And I remember she said something that pissed me off, and I lost it on her. I just started calling her all kinds of names, talking all kinds of shit. And my brother like stepped in. He's like, hey man, like I can't have you talk to her like this, you know? And I'm like, let's go, Aaron. That's my brother's name. And we just started fighting. And he actually hit me in the face, and that pissed me off so bad. That was the first time he'd ever hit me in the face. And I punched him, so I'm not surprised, but I was like, what the fuck, dude? So yeah. We got in a fight. We were breaking everything, dude. Like, it was an Airbnb, too, so it was just...
That's wild. That's like almost something you'd see in like an action movie where like there's tables shattering and shit. And
dude, it was like that, like
flower pots toppling over.
Yes, man. Matter of fact, I think there was flower pots too, because it was like a nice log cabin. It was snowing at the time. And anyway, this is like I still it's hard to talk about this. And I was thinking about it today. Gonna have to talk about this because it's just so bad. So bad what I said. And I remember like telling him, I'm like, dude, I'm gonna kill your kids. And I grabbed the knife and I just started chasing the kids around the house with a knife. And I think I told you, I don't know, I was hammered, so I don't like, I love to think like, dude, you were never really gonna do anything, you were just trying to scare kids. But just the fact that I did that is like, it still kind of messes with me today. And I thought about you earlier because you asked me on that call, have you ever forgiven yourself for all this stuff? And I thought about you because I was at a spot where I used to pick up drugs, and I'm like, maybe I haven't ever forgiven myself for any of this stuff that I've ever, you know, that I've done. But anyway, I pull the knife, I'm chasing the kids around, and finally somehow it cooled off. My wife ended up taking me home that night, and she said to me, like, dude, like, you have to stop or else I'm leaving. Like, I can't do this with you anymore. And I woke up, like, what the hell happened? And
oh, you didn't remember?
No, I didn't. I didn't like remember. I didn't remember everything, how it unfolded. Like, there was like little, you know, pieces of it, but I was just like, no way, you know, no way that happened. And that was the last time I stopped drinking that day. I'm like, I have to stop. And then I told you, my wife, we went on the trip to Jamaica, and I remember I had a couple drinks there, but it wasn't the same. I didn't really like it. It wasn't like that feeling wasn't, you know, it was like, okay, this is stupid. Like, I already can tell that if I continue to do this, I'm going to end up dead or in prison for sure. Or hurt.
It's almost like at that point in time, your drinking was ruined. Like, was never going to be the same after something like that, right?
After that moment, it was like, yeah, exactly. It was ruined. Like, there was no fun in it anymore. Like, if that's something I'm capable of doing drunk, I don't even want to do it. You know, like,
I just want to say something quick, like, and I hope that you believe this too. Like, I don't believe that people are their actions. I believe that, you know, actions can represent people, but I also believe that, you know, especially in the deep pits of addiction or alcoholism or whatever it may be, like, people do crazy things. I mean, people go into psychosis, people completely lose themselves. It's almost like they become soulless until they tap back into it and sober up and remember who they are. So I just want to emphasize that because, you know, like you said, it's probably, you know, it's been hard to even forgive yourself for something like that because it just on the surface seems so crazy and so messed up. But I think that's what stuff like that, while it is sad to hear and to think back on and stuff like that, I'm sure for you, like that kind of stuff has made you into a guy that has his head on straight. I mean, you're on a podcast right now talking about a success story and a faith journey. So I just want to emphasize that as we get into, you know, the topic of that redemption and that faith.
Yeah, thank you. And you're right. Like, that's the reflection stuff. When I look back, I have to remember, like, the reason I'm where I'm at right now is because that happened. You know, like, if that wouldn't have happened, I wouldn't be the person I am right now. I wouldn't be sober, like, no chance of ever doing any of that stuff. Like, there's zero chance. I can say that confidently, you know? So that's, yeah, everything happens for a reason. And that all led me up to here. And one thing I remember, and I kind of forgot about this, but people always told me when I was sober that, like, have you ever seen this guy sober? Like, he's a completely different person. And I think about that a lot because it makes me kind of, you know, feel, it makes me feel a little bit better. Like, dude, you're not that guy, that crazy psychotic like person. You're a good dude. That stuff made you that way. The demons in you when you drank, that made you that way. So like, yeah. that's comforting, I guess you can say.
It is interesting. Like, I've known a lot of people that have had you know, alcohol issues, drug issues. And it's funny how some of the best people I've ever met in my whole life are the people who, when sober, if sober, are amazing people, and they're addicts. Because I feel like a lot of times addicts can just feel so deeply. So like whenever that's uncovered in a sober setting, it's like an instant connection, and like you can really dive into things that matter and stuff like that. But that's also kind of the downfall of the addict too, because you feel things so deeply that it drives you to want to feel different. And the only reason, like we're talking about people who say, I drink for the taste. And like, yeah, I think a, you know, cold Miller Lite tastes pretty decent, but I think a Diet Dr. Pepper or sweet tea tastes better. And right. there's these people who say I drink, you know, for the taste or for the flavor or just whatever. And to that I would say bullshit, because I think that whether we consciously know it or not, whatever we reach for, and I'm not knocking drinking or, you know, occasional like smoke of weed or stuff like that. I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying that if we're honest with ourselves, we pick it up because we want to feel differently than we feel right now. It could be, you know, we want to kind of get down into our sadness and kind of wallow. It could be, you know, I got a promotion. I want to have a great night. And it's like, okay, why does it have to come to that to have a great night? And I think that that's where that there's an emptiness in all of us that sometimes, unfortunately, is filled with substances or, you know, things that we maybe shouldn't be doing or that aren't healthy for us.
Yeah, like I agree 100%. Drinking, there's no such, it doesn't taste good. I mean, it may taste good, but you want that temporary escape. Same thing with weed or anything. And like you said, I'm not knocking anybody for shit. I can't, you know, I did it like crazy. So yeah, it's a temporary escape. You want to not be in your normal state. So that's why you do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's also very interesting that you got sober from, you know, a final event instead of, I feel like a lot of people have to do a 12-step program or you have to be in some sort of, you know, sobriety circle or, you know, some form of accountability. And I'm sure that you had that with some of the people that you're close with in your life. But I do think it's interesting that there is a million different ways to get sober, and one way doesn't have to look the same for everyone.
Yeah, I feel like I lucked out in that way. Like, there's people that end up going to prison when they do stupid shit. I lucked out. Like, I never ended up getting caught doing anything. I always kind of, like, somehow got out of it. And, yeah, I didn't ever have to do AA or any type of, like, the only treatment I did was that methadone. But other than that, I mean, yeah, I completely just stopped on my own because I knew where it would take me, you know? Like, there was... I didn't need anybody to tell me, hey, you need to stop. I know I need to stop, you know, like I knew it. So yeah, I definitely lucked out.
Yeah. I mean, how much of that luck came from, you know, a newfound faith in Jesus though?
Oh no, 100%. Matter of fact too, like I got in shape. Like I started doing, like I told you, that 75 hard, I did all that kind of stuff. Like you have to stay busy. So you do have to kind of, I guess it's like almost self-treatment. I can't really say I didn't do anything. I just walked away. Like I found other avenues. They were just healthier avenues. You know, like I said, right. Working out, eating healthy, started getting into like physical fitness, like the training part of it, training people. So that was kind of my new drug, I guess, is just being healthy. God came into it like pretty recently, and this is the part we didn't really get to on our call, is not so recently. Like I had like weird beliefs. Like I always believed in God, I believed in Jesus Christ. I always thought that Jesus was like one of us, but that just tapped into God power. I remember before I got into faith that I have right now in Jesus Christ, I thought he was a human being born just like anybody else that knew how to like tap into this special power from God. And I remember having debates with my dad, like, no, the Bible's real. This is that, but this is who Jesus was. And my dad would always tell me, no, son, this is who Jesus is. And I would, just, we would debate, go back and forth. There was even, have you ever looked into like the Book of Enoch and like the lost Gospels?
Yeah, so I haven't read them personally. I've read about them, and I think it actually, funny enough, my haircut lady of like 10 years, she told me that she, you know, found those and it kind of just changed her perspective on everything. So I've been interested to get into those.
So yeah, I looked into those and I started like thinking though, like first of all, the Bible, you have to remember the Bible is what it is. You can't like. Anything that's not in there is not really accepted. So I was always in. I was telling my dad about these books, and he was like, "That's not accepted. This and that." And I just, my whole belief wasn't what it is right now. And but I was, you know, I was still, I believed, you know. And then there was one day I was sitting in church, and I prayed to God. I'm like, and I was doing all my Instagram, my walks, but it was way more about motivation, and I didn't really use Bible verses or anything like that. I was sitting in church, and I said, you know, God, what do you want me to do? Like, I'm giving myself to you. Like, I show me my purpose. What do you want me to do? And there's a verse that came on the screen at church, and I remember going home, doing that verse on my walk, and from that day forward, I just started doing all Bible verses. This is verse of the day. Turned kind of reading, analyzing, and then translating the verses and kind of trying to make it a little bit about discipline, leadership, and motivation, but through the gospel. And through that, like, that's kind of what, like, led me to this place right now, which, like, really changed my life. And this just happened, like, March last year, maybe even April or May.
So your Instagram, and what's your Instagram handle again?
Die_fit_official. So it's Die Fit is the company. And yeah, I started that last year. I started doing that seriously in like March, I think. And if you go back to my very beginning, it was like food. I was doing like healthy stuff. It was about like, it was a motivational fitness brand. It wasn't anything to do with faith, you know, or Jesus mm-hmm. Christ. But since I've been doing this, that's when I was like, wait a minute. Okay. Jesus isn't one of us. Jesus is God in the flesh, came down to save us and show us really the correct way to live. And he died on the cross for our sins to save us, you know. And that's kind of, that's what really got me into the faith position that I'm in right now.
Yeah, I noticed looking, I watch your videos every day. One, because, you know, I want to support you, but two, because I get something out of them. Yeah. And I think that's a huge commitment too. So kudos to you, because you know you're posting every single day, and you always say, another day, another chance to show up.
Yeah, it's structure over motivation. Inspired for sure. Like motivation is gonna fade. You know, like everybody gets motivated. You wake up and you see something. You're scrolling on your phone, and you maybe even see one of my videos or something, and you get a little motivated to get up and do something. But that motivation is going to fade throughout the day unless you actually had that my video playing nonstop to where it's like in your friggin' face all day. You're gonna forget about it at some point. So like you gotta, and that's why even it's inspiration. Inspiration is good too, but structure, like structuring your day, planning your day. And knowing what you're going to do and doing all that before anything else. That's really what, like, I think gets you ahead and creates winning days.
Yeah, and I feel like it doesn't have to be a day where you made a bunch of money or whatever, but I think that as humans, we are designed to at least be hard workers. Like we were made to work and to accomplish things. And, you know, not everyone needs a rigid structure. Some people do, some people don't. But I think without any structure, you're right. I mean, that's when you kind of lose yourself. That's when you kind of forget what your purpose might be in life. And that structure, at least for me, like that's a big thing to where it's like, okay, now I can enjoy my days because I feel accomplished. I feel like I set out to do tasks, and then I completed those tasks, and now, you know, maybe I'll reward myself at the end of the day or something like that. You know, it could be ice cream, or it could be, you know, an activity, or, you know, whatever it may be. But without that structure, I feel like there's no, like, okay, I did all this, and then, like, I should pat myself on the back because I accomplished the day.
Yeah, and I think that's what's cool about that app. The operational standard is like, see, like you said, like eating ice cream or maybe even like for some people, finishing their task is like maybe cracking a beer or something, and that's that reward factor. But like, it's the trick is really finding a totally different style of reward, like giving yourself maybe like a point system or something, and then maybe at the instead of every day, like at the end of the week, like for me, I eat really healthy and I work out every day. At the end of the week, if I complete all my stuff, I might reward myself with like a healthy cheat meal. So like I'll make like the healthiest pizza you can think of, and I'll eat that instead of like a normal pizza. But any way you look at it, like I'm not trying to tell people how to live. You can do however you want. You want to get some ice cream or have a beer? Sure. You know, I mean, that's not my personal choice, but some people, whatever makes you feel good without hurting yourself or hurting others.
That's what just came to mind as you were talking, is like everything I just described was I did good, so I'm gonna reward myself with something that hurts me. Like that is such a weird psychological thing that we naturally tap into, and it's like wow.
Yes, and you're like it's Corinthians, and I'm trying. I don't know the exact verse. And that's one thing I tell everybody is like, when you get into God and the gospel and scripture, don't think you have to know everything by heart right off. Like I pick a Bible verse every day. I read a book called Jesus CEO, and there's a Bible verse in there. So that's kind of my inspiration for every piece of content I put out. Is inspired by something I'm reading. So I tell people, I don't just have Bible knowledge in my head and just spit it out. You know, like I read the verse and then I break it down. There's all kinds of like, you go on Google and break down a verse, and then you kind of just make it your own. But the one, like we were just talking about the reward, your body is a temple, right? That's Corinthians, and I'm going to try to find out which verse it is. 1 Corinthians chapter 16 or chapter 6 verse 19 through 20. That's do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit? So like you're rewarding yourself, but reward yourself in the right ways, right? Like your body is the temple. You don't want to reward yourself, like you said, it's going to hurt yourself. Might be good, it's temporary, it's temp that temporary escape, but in the end it's going to hurt you.
Right. Yeah, I think there's that, and then there's the moderation piece, but I think what's tricky about moderation is that the lines get blurry when you talk about rewarding yourself, and then moderation, because that moderation can quickly turn into a habit.
Oh yeah, 100%. And I struggle with it almost every at the end of every year. Like so, I get really in shape, and I'm like, I've done a men's physique show, and ever since then, I kind of like, I get shredded, and then come November, December, something like I reward myself. With I didn't eat any sugar up until November, so it's holidays. I'm gonna have some pie. I'm gonna have some cookies. Next thing you know it, January comes around, and I'm back to square one where I got it. This is the year I finally was like, you know what, dude, I'm not doing this again. Like this year, I'm not having cookies and pie. I'm gonna go all the way through, because like, dude, it sucks. When you get in really good shape and you're cut and you look like a chiseled Greek god, and I hate to say that, but like your body looks just chiseled out. Like, and then you step in front of the mirror, especially if you've ever been like, because I started off kind of like, I was like a skinny fat. Like I wasn't in shape at all. So when you start off like that, then you get in shape, you make this incredible transformation, and then you go back to that, you're like, what the, dude, that was so hard to get there. Now I'm beating myself up trying to get there again, and it's like a cycle. And that's those when you try to moderate it or whatever, like moderation, dude, it's going to happen where you're just gonna binge eat, and you're gonna keep doing it and doing it and doing it again until you look like crap, and then you've got to fight hard again to get back to where you want to be. I would eat like, I'll tell myself I'm gonna give myself a cookie. I love cookies, chocolate chip cookies. There's a place called you have Sprouts out there.
Yeah, we do.
So, see, Sprouts, I don't know, they make the best friggin' chocolate chip cookies ever. To me, they do. I think they're so damn good. Dude, especially the gluten-free ones. So they come in like this bag of six. And I'll go there, I'm like, I'm just gonna have one. I eat one. By the time I get home, I eat the whole bag. And then I tell myself, dude, you know how to get back in shape. You're gonna be okay. It's okay to just do this every once in a while. So the next day, you crave it and you crave it and you crave it, and you're just going to keep eating it and eating it and eating it. So, like the moderation thing, it don't work for me. I don't know how other people can do it, but for me, it just doesn't work. Like I can't, which is crazy because I have discipline too. You know, like you don't get in shape and not have discipline. You know, like you have to be able to eat healthy consistently, like really consistently, in order to get in shape. So I don't, it's not lack of discipline, man. I don't know what it is, but it's just those damn cookies will get you every time. So,
yeah. You say I'm in shape. Like that to me, whenever you say it, sounds like that means that you have like hardly any body fat. You have been eating healthy. You've been exercising a lot. But I have always kind of thought, like, I've seen people who are in really, really good shape, but they don't do all that stuff. They work out. So, like, they're physically in good shape, but, you know, maybe they've got some fat on them or something like that. But, like, they can still go run 10 miles. They can still, you know, do all the physical activities. And that's kind of what I have always considered in shape.
Yeah, and I guess everybody has their own, like, way of looking at it. Yeah, I mean, even when I was eating that stuff, I could still do, like, the elliptical or walk stairs for 30 minutes. But I just, I mean, more physically, the appearance. But yeah, you can still be in shape and eat like that. I do think that it will end up catching up with you, because you do feel sluggish when you eat like sugary processed foods. So anybody you see that can go out there and run those like 5Ks or really hit their cardio hard, there's no way they're eating unhealthy processed sugary foods consistently. They might have it every once in a while, but I don't think you can be in shape and have that as a regular part of your diet.
Dude, thank you so much for sharing your journey. You know, I know this stuff is personal and you haven't shared it publicly before, but, you know, I really think that this is something that I really think that this is an episode where it's going to touch the right people. And that wouldn't have happened without you being so bold as to come on here and share it. And I can't thank you enough. So thank you so much.
This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces, hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com.